Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. I'm a moviegoer and you're a moviegoer. And it is certainly the case that lots of movies are merely movies and don't necessarily have any great depth, though depth maybe sneaks in almost inadvertently and without the intention of the director or the actors. Then you can argue that there are many filmmakers who are doing much with film that is of a literary or even of a philosophical or possibly even of a theological import. That is the contention about Clint Eastwood, which is voiced by Sarah Anson Vaux, who is a film scholar. She's based at Northwestern University, and she's done a new book titled The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood. Fascinating reading with reference to many fascinating and very important films. And we'll talk about those films. We'll talk about the career of Eastwood. We'll play some scenes from some of the films. And all of that will commence right after the update on this evening's news from, I presume, Paula Cooper.
It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
I'll only say this once. I've never said it before. But this kind of certainty comes but just once in a lifetime.
We thought we'd start with a film clip representing Clint Eastwood. That is Eastwood, of course. Did you recognize the scene? It's from The Bridges of Madison County. And that is Eastwood, is it not, Sarah Vaux, at his most romantic?
Yes, I think so. In so many of the other movies, Dirty Harry, and then the ones he's directed, his wife is dead. They're separated. He's estranged from his children. He's lonely.
In one of the Dirty Harrys, there's a young lady living in the same boarding house, or rooming house, who is flirting with him, and he has a brief encounter with her, I think. But basically, yes, he's a loner.
He's a loner, right.
Yeah. Sarah Vaux, our guest tonight, is the author of a new book, The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood. Sarah Anson Vaux, V-A-U-X, a very interesting volume. It's published by Erdmans. You may very well want to get your hands on it. It's well written, and it runs through not all of his films, but how many films are reviewed?
Oh, 15.
Analyzed? 15 films.
15 with partial references to another half dozen.
Yeah. What drew you to him? You are trained in seminaries. You're an active religionist and a political activist on the left, so to speak. One would think that his tough guy stance, particularly the Dirty Harry image of him, which is long since established, might have put you off.
No, that's a fair question. Actually, because Unforgiven is the first movie I really got involved with, I got into the heart of his concerns immediately. And one of his biggest concerns throughout his career has been justice. Justice tempered with mercy. And the ways that human beings strive to live together, to understand themselves, and then to live together without butchering each other or to reconcile.
Well, but after all, in The Unforgiven, he is a hired assassin. He and that wonderful black actor.
Right, Morgan Freeman, who plays Ned, his best friend.
They're paid to go on up to another town. Is it in Montana or Wyoming or whatever?
Wyoming, right.
And to kill some men who badly treated some girls in a house of prostitution, and they are on a murderer's mission, and they do indeed do the murders. Justice, compassion.
Ah, yes, you have to see the movie, though.
I've seen
of course,
the movie.
Yeah. That's one of the beauties of Eastwood's movies. Actually, are you can say the bare lines of the plot. You say, okay, two bounty hunters, they're on a mission to kill for money.
Yeah.
But there's so much that leads up to it. And you get the backstory. You know that they were in the Civil War, which is the backdrop for so many of Eastwood's movies, his westerns. You know that they couldn't stop killing. There was no employment. Miraculously, both of these characters did stop. One, because the Eastwood character, Will Money, he's fallen in love with a young woman who converts him to Christianity and teaches him another way to live. And Ned marries a lovely woman, and they become farmers. So they have had the chance to build community and to redeem the awful aftermath of the Civil War. But because of the bad economic, the horrible economic conditions of actually the Eastwood character, then he decides to take on this killing mission for his children. So it's complicated. You're fairly deep into the movie before you say, oh, my goodness, we've already identified with the Eastwood character. Now we've identified with Morgan Freeman's character, Ned. We don't want them to do this. But, you know, the fact that they do continue, along the way, justice is turned this way and turned that way, and you feel like you understand the American scene so much better by the time you finish.
And Eastwood does his final killing after Morgan Freeman has been tortured and killed by the opponents.
Yes, exactly.
So at that point, it's revenge as well.
Well, that's kind of interesting. When anyone talks to me about Unforgiven, they'll always say, well, it's such a bloody movie at the end there. He kills seven people in a row, and it's just this flash of gunfire. But again, if one of the fantastic things about Eastwood, not only as a philosopher but an artist, is that he leads up to that point so slowly and deliberately that you realize the tone, the scene, the coloring, the timing of the cutting changes completely, and you're in mythic territory.
We're going to deal more with that film. It's a film that does preoccupy me a bit from as I read through your book and remembering my original viewing of that movie. Right now we're about to pause for some commercials. But when we come back, we come to the original established image that he put before us in film. And these were films, most of them not even directed by him, namely the Dirty Harry films. I think he did direct the last Dirty Harry himself.
He did.
And we're going to get a Dirty Harry scene and talk about that image and what it meant to convey and what it stands for in the continued iconography of Hollywood films. Directly back to Sarah Ann Vaux, drawing from Sarah Anson Vaux, drawing from her new book, The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood. First, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We return to Sarah Anson Vaux and to Clint Eastwood, or rather we return to Dirty Harry. You remember that at the time the Dirty Harry films were made and were so popular, there were many writing critically or otherwise who said these are essentially fascistic films. What was the basis of that accusation?
Oh, heavenly days. Well, Eastwood himself was always concerned with justice, as were his two mentors, Sergio Leone, who directed him in
those famous spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, the famous spaghetti westerns who just burst onto the American scene. And then Don Siegel, who was a real mentor who taught him how to direct. But the justice piece of Dirty Harry and the second Dirty Harry was really exploring the dark side of the American frontier tendency to want vigilante justice. That is, a vigilante, such as we've recently experienced, wanting to right all wrongs by himself or herself, in the case of one of the...
Without the agencies of law restraining him or shaping his... But essentially, he's a lone avenger.
Well, he is. I mean, Dirty Harry begins working within the law, but he's very frustrated by these Miranda declarations.
And by the bureaucracy of the law, and also by the fact that some of the people in law are corrupt.
Right.
Here is a scene, a famous scene, which also provided a line later on for President of the United States. This, of course, is from Sudden Impact, the fourth, I think, of the Dirty Harry sequence.
Every day for the last 10 years, Loretta there has been giving me a large black coffee. Today she gives me a large black coffee, only it's got sugar in it. A lot of sugar. I just came back to complain. Now you boys put those guns down.
Say what?
We're not just gonna let you walk out of here.
Who is we, sucker?
Smith and Wesson and me. My day.
Didn't Ronald Reagan use that as a line in one of his speeches?
Yeah.
Or maybe more than once.
Yeah.
Dirty Harry is facing the last of the gag. He's shot down all the others, and that guy pulls a gun.
Yeah.
And they're both pointing guns at one another, and go ahead, make my day.
Yeah.
Something most curious, most interesting about this is that there's some... four or five guys that he shoots down in that scene. They're robbing that coffee shop.
Right.
They are all black. Yeah. There's no touch of political correctness where you mix up the personnel in the gang.
Yeah. No, that's extremely disturbing when you see the movie. And then I remind myself that Eastwood didn't direct it. I forget who did, actually.
I think that Don Siegel did.
Oh.
Didn't he? Oh, no, this is the fourth in the sequence.
It's the fourth one.
Yeah.
I can't remember who directed it. But it doesn't belong to...
If he were directing it, would you have made...
It would have been a more mixed race
gang,
right,
would you? Yeah.
Right, I think so. But Eastwood...
But this has verisimilitude.
Right, yeah. But part of why it works so well, if you can say so well, and also why it was called fascistic, is that there was a lot of violence and crime in cities at that particular time, and law enforcement officers and the public were screaming hysterically, not thinking about, say, schools, better health care, better family structures, but they were thinking, how can we wipe a scourge, some scourge, out of our lives? Whereas Eastwood, the director, always goes to the basics and thinks about, how can we rebuild communities? How can we rebuild relationships?
You organize his films into four main categories. Let's look at what those categories are and what you think he does generally in each of those categories.
Oh, all right. The first one is The Angel of Death. Refers to four of his westerns, four wonderful westerns, High Plains Drifter, Outlaw Josie Wales, Pale Rider, and Unforgiven. The angel of death phrase, not only is it biblical, but it's from one of the dreams that Eastwood has when he's the Eastwood character in Unforgiven, when he's dying. He's seen the angel of death, which is the angel of judgment, very relevant for Eastwood. The second one is The Mysteries of Life, in which I group four films from his recent period where it seems to me he's probing theologically as well as ethically, why do terrible things happen? Who, if anyone, runs this world? Why do children have to suffer? That would be Mystic River, Million Dollar Baby, Bird.
It's the rabbi's classic question, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or to anyone.
Yeah.
Right? And the third one are the war movies. And the fourth one I call Hereafter. When I was finishing the book, Hereafter, the movie had just come out, and it turned out not only was it marvelous, and did I get to meet the female lead, Marie de France, who was a Belgian actress, but I saw it at the film festival and saw it again. But in that film, the Matt Damon character, his life is maintained, sustained, and saved by Charles Dickens. Well, Charles Dickens is one of my favorites, and apparently one of Eastwood's favorites, too, because, say, in A Christmas Carol or Bleak House or Little Dorrit, references to all three of those are in that movie. The theme, here they are, they're Eastwood themes about drawing on the past, reassessing the past, reliving past memories, assessing them in the present, and then looking into the future, getting lessons from the future to carry you into the present to live a better life.
What you seem to be saying with regard to all four of those categories is that there's some sort of transition from selfishness and maybe even relapse into barbarity towards towards social identity and towards, if not brotherhood, at least some sense of social obligation.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And so that's the ethical meaning, you would say.
Right. Yes, right. I mean, Eastwood is always aware of the barbarity into which we can so easily slip. I mean, High Plains Drifter is the movie that anyone who wants to understand Eastwood totally would see, because it's archetypal, it's mythical, it's clean, a clean summary of what's happened to the American dream,
mm-hmm.
really. You know, this, well, I won't go into it, actually, but the Eastwood character is neither alive nor dead, but comes back from the grave to avenge his own death on the townspeople who passively watched him being whipped to death. That is, it's not only his murder, but the people who allowed it to happen. Pale Rider, the character, is also dead, right? But there's a movement in that one very much mm-hmm. toward social rebirth. And
what odd film of his that quite fascinated me. Maybe it just occurs to me because I do a radio program, uh-huh. was Play Misty for Me.
Oh, I wondered what you would think of that. Yes,
I saw it a long time ago. I haven't seen it recently.
Yeah.
But there the DJ gives way to a young woman who's infatuated with him
right.
by virtue of hearing him on the air.
Yeah.
But she is crazy.
She's
ultimately a killer.
Yes, she is. Murderous rage. Oh, that one. That one is a combination of totally crazy and violent and absolutely redemptive. Because
how is it redemptive?
Well, it's redemptive because the Eastwood character, this beautiful creature who sings and loves jazz and is the radio announcer and wants to bring love and life and music out to the community, has a beautiful girlfriend, is estranged from the girlfriend, the loving girlfriend, and nature. The dark side of himself takes over and gets involved with this woman, and the consequences of that action are visited on himself. But he actually is able to, how would I say it's redemptive? He's able to rejoin and redeem himself with his beloved. And you feel like he's been reunited with nature. Anyway, it's also a gorgeous movie. It's a work of art. You know.
Cinematically, he does. Yeah. He directed that one,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. It's one of his first.
One of his first. Mm-hmm. So he's directed himself a great deal in the second half of his career, really.
Right.
Yeah. What do you make of his use of image as such? What's the picture in his films? Is he innovative or is he essentially just traditional? Does he do things unusual with the camera? Should he bother?
Oh, goodness. Because he's interested primarily in human relationships, his shots are very carefully composed. And he uses a lot of darkness, soft darkness.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When light is used, it's not, say, the God light that some film directors use, you know, a halo around the head or something. It's usually associated with evil, as in Mystic River, where Dave is shot at the end. And then there's a burst of light and organ music, and you go on to a patriotic celebration. Or the same thing happens in Heartbreak Ridge, where at the end of the movie there's a patriotic celebration in bright, jarring light. Or in Million Dollar Baby, where the parents and family, dysfunctional family of our heroine, are all shot in harsh light and harsh line.
Yeah.
But it's the warm, comforting darkness and the compositions that bring people together is in the scene that you played from Bridges of Madison County mm-hmm. that makes him so distinctive.
You mentioned his war films as a third category,
right.
but you said nothing about them. You said his war films, and then you went on to the fourth.
Oh, right.
What about his war films? Pair of films, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, is really an astonishing achievement, I'd say.
It is. It's. I refer in the book to it being a diptych in the religious
yes.
sense. And Invictus being the triptych, the third one that is naturally paired with the others
mm-hmm.
or tried with the others. And then the Gran Torino actually belongs as not an appendix, but it's like the frosting on the war films. It's
well, he's an old veteran.
Yeah, he's a veteran. He's lived through the Korean War. So yeah. that's one of the many wars that Eastwood thought was badly managed and took mm-hmm. young boys and destroyed them.
We're due for an update on the news. But when we return, I want to talk with you particularly about, because I just watched it again mm-hmm. just a few nights ago, about Letters from Iwo Jima, which I found just exceptionally
interesting
and superbly crafted and with some wonderful performances. So I want to do sort of a brief panegyric, or have you do it, for that particular film. When we return, after an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight is Sarah Anson Vaux, who teaches film, among many other things that she does, up at Northwestern University, and is the author of the new book, The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood. I want to read you just a few lines from a review of this book of yours that appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education. In her new book, The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood, Sarah Anson Vaux becomes the latest scholar to tidy up Eastwood, this time with theology. These are perceptive, detailed readings of the major films, though they move in a single direction. Vaux was once puzzled by the, quote, radical disjunction in Eastwood between the, quote, vengeful American killer and the artist of, quote, eloquence and compassion. Now she's no longer confused. And a quote, during the months that followed my first revealing viewing of Unforgiven, the director, whom I now know and love, was to fully emerge, champion of the weak and forgotten in American society, enemy of racism and staunch opponent of vigilante justice. We're back to that same kind of paradox that I started our discussion with. These are killers, after all, but you see them as full of compassion and serving justice.
Mm. In Unforgiven.
Yeah.
The movie is moving for mercy
mm-hmm.
and justice tempered with mercy. For instance, when Ned and Will and a third character who goes along with them
The young apprentice killer.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. The kid who parrots all the old nasty cliches about the wonders of vigilante justice. I mean, even the parroting the false language
yeah.
marks it as being completely a fraud. But he's there. He can't see a thing. They've got the people they're chasing to kill right in front of them. That scene is so long. It's drawn out
yeah.
so long.
Yeah.
And it's full of so much nuance. The Morgan Freeman character can't bear to kill. And right after that leaves the little group of so-called bounty hunters. Eastwood doesn't want to kill. The Eastwood character doesn't want to kill the kid either. And he keeps saying, only reason I'm doing that is for the money so I can feed my kids. The suffering of one of the people they're chasing who's been hit, the young boy, Davy. His suffering is just unbelievable. And Eastwood's character says, give the kid some water. All right. You can't think this is a good, clean shoot.
And here's a very interesting scene which touches on another matter. They've gone there because they're paid to revenge women who were cut up by nasty cowboys, the women working in a house of prostitution.
Right.
And here, one of them comes to talk with him. That is one of the girls at the bordello.
The girl who was cut up.
The girl who was, yeah. in fact, cut up. Here's the scene.
I thought I was gone. I wouldn't normally pay no notice to high country like this. Trees, but I'm sure notice them now. I thought I was dying for sure.
I brought your hat. You left it down at Greeley's.
Thanks. Sheriff? Are you still looking for me?
Little Bill? No, he thinks you went south. Are you really gonna kill them cowboys?
I guess. Still a payment coming, isn't there?
Them other two, your friends, they've been taking advances on the payment.
Advances?
Free ones?
Free ones?
Alice and Silky been giving them free ones.
I see.
Would you like a free one?
No, I guess not.
I didn't mean with me. I meant, Alice and Silky would be happy to give you a free one if you wanted one. That's all I meant.
Oh, I didn't mean I didn't want a free one on account of you being cut up and all. And what I said the other day about you looking like me, that ain't true. You ain't ugly like me. It's just that we both got scars. But you're a beautiful woman, and if I was to want a free one, I'd want it with you, I guess, more than them other two. Just that I can't on account of my wife.
Your wife?
Yeah. You see,
I admire you for that. For being true to your wife and all. I've known a lot of men who weren't.
Yeah, I suppose.
Is she back in Kansas?
Yeah. Yeah, she's watching over my young one.
Do I remember correctly that, in fact, his wife is dead?
She's dead.
Yeah.
She is. And later, Dalila finds that out. Yeah. But it's kind of thrown away. I'm glad that we played that, because these are two of the most beautiful sequences in any American movie. This particular one is indeed shot in bright sunlight with the snow-covered mountains beyond in a cabin, the outside of a cabin. It follows a death scene. The Eastwood character, Will, has been beaten nearly to the point of death and nursed by his friends. And nursed by the prostitutes back to life. Dalila has come now after 3 days. He's come out of the cabin. She's fed him. And they have this life-giving exchange. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Part of the way that it's so remarkable, the way the scenes are shot, is there's a very much a Michelangelo da Vinci sort of feel to the darkness of the three-day mm-hmm. death scene. And then the resurrection scene, bright light. He's sitting down. She's up above him, which is very unusual gender arrangement. And at one point, she returns his hat. It's a beautiful shot. The hat is the cowboy's symbol of power. And she brings it back to him, gives it straight across to him. But he doesn't cover his head. He leaves his head uncovered to the beauties of nature and to this life-giving exchange.
Has he been properly and fully comprehended by the general audiences?
Oh, it depends on who you're talking about, I suppose. It's interesting. I just spent a sabbatical last spring in Paris, and I have kids living in Europe, blah, blah, blah. And I have a wonderful group of friends at University of Chicago and now Northwestern They immediately, every person I've met over the course of the last couple of years, when they find out I'm writing on Eastwood, they'll quote, make my day, or they'll quote, do you feel lucky, punk? Mm-hmm. But then, you know, how many times the last movie someone just saw, so they say, ho, 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 they quote Dirty Harry in the mean voice. And then they'll say, oh, but I just saw Hereafter, and what a marvelous movie, and they'll talk about the Dickensian themes. Or they'll have seen Iwo Jima, or they've seen Flags of Our Fathers, and we get into these incredible exchanges. Now what I hear are people who've seen Gran Torino, and they say, wasn't that fantastic, playing off the Dirty Harry and spaghetti Western image and having this beautiful inclusion of the American immigrant, the other.
Yeah.
Into a family, a new family.
And a sacrificial life.
And a sacrificial life, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We are due for a last round of commercials, but also it's time to invite telephone calls. We'll have time for a number of calls if you get in there quickly. The number, of course, 312-591-7200. Any questions you've got, or for that matter, any reactions you've got to the films we've discussed or the many other films directed by or acted in or both by Clint Eastwood, we'd love to hear from you. Appreciations, then, and critical interpretations of the Eastwood opera, that is, many separate opuses. 312-591-7200, the number, 312-591-7200. And for email, wherever you are listening over the Internet, the email address is, as it ever is, extension720@wgnradio.com. Extension 720 is one word, at wgnradio.com. And again, for calls, 312-591-7200. Get your calls and emails in quickly. We'll be with you right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to our guest for the evening, Sarah Anson Vaux, author of The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood, and we'll go directly to the phones on 312-591-7200, and first up is Joe. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening. I just wanted to ask the author if she also covers in her work Clint Eastwood's, I think, excellent use of film music in his films, especially also his kind of unique relationships with Lalo Schifrin and Jerry Fielding from his movies.
Yes, I do actually cover the music. It's so critical to detailing, unspooling the meanings in the movies. Fielding, I'm thinking my probably favorite is the score for Josie Wales. There's, of course, Bird, and then Unforgiven, which doesn't have much music, but where it's there, it's such a an evocative melody.
Doesn't he write some of his own music for some of the films?
He does. He does. Right. As a great jazz lover.
Yeah.
That's how he earned his living when he first settled.
Started life as a jazz pianist.
He did. Yeah. Right.
As
in
a kid.
Club. As a kid. Right. Yeah.
Sarah, we thank you for the call. And quickly to another on 312-591-7200. Craig is next in line. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
All right. I'd just like to say, I've forgotten the name of the man who wrote The Unforgiven, but I just think it's one of the strongest scripts ever put on film, and just amazing. And my favorite description of the movie came from an elderly lady, and I'm not remembering exactly who said that what she loved about the movie was how Clint Eastwood went for most of the movie without being Clint Eastwood and then turned into Clint Eastwood at the end.
All right. The heavily marketed Clint Eastwood at the end. It's totally in the context of the movie. It goes from one kind of narrative mode to another. He is so Eastwood, the artistic, philosophical, musical director in 95% of the movie, and then at the end, in the so-called payoff, he goes into the mythic mode. But the whole movie. Pardon me.
I'm sorry. Can you remind me the name of the author of the movie? The scriptwriter.
The scriptwriter of
The Unforgiven. Yeah, David Webb Peebles. people's.
I understand the movie went unmade for several years.
Yes, actually, 10 years. Eastwood was waiting until he seasoned up and got old enough to do it.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Let's go quickly to another. Time is short, and lots of people want to get in on this conversation at 312-591-7200. And next is Ryan. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Sarah. I'm sorry. I was just calling to see what you thought about Clint Eastwood's take on the Madonna versus horror complex in Unforgiven.
Oh, my.
And if you think that's his working out of the issue.
Yeah, I see his use of women in that film more as paying attention to the prostitutes as people. They've been turned into commodities. They've been bought and brought out their chattels. But they get a lot of screen time, and particularly when they're deciding what to do about the mutilation of Delilah. I mean, there are five different personalities. Delilah is definitely a saintly. She's a saintly character. She's coded as a pure character, even though she's a prostitute. He's very respectful of all the women. I don't see that kind of an opposition.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call. And next we go to Dave. Good evening, sir. You are on the air.
Oh, sir, was my father's name, Milt.
It's all right.
To talk to you both. Listen, nobody's mentioned Paint Your Wagon, Clint Eastwood.
Oh. That's a disaster.
Come on.
Well, he sang, didn't he?
isn't that the one real disaster in his career?
Yeah, it is. But he didn't direct it.
Disaster. It was a wonderful, wonderful film. If you watch it, Lee Marvin, it's great. The other thing I was going to bring up real quick is the best line was from Bronco Billy.
Oh, I love Bronco Billy.
Yeah, when somebody asked him why he was in prison, well, he walked in on his best friend and his wife making love, and he shot his best friend. Or, no, he shot his
wife. He shot his wife. Mm-hmm.
And the fella said, "Why'd you shoot your wife?" He goes, "Well, I couldn't shoot him. He was my best friend."
Yes, that's great.
It was wonderfully innocent, and he's, like, really... That's a really good movie. A lot of people, that and Pink Cadillac, they're very good Clint Eastwood movies.
So is Honky Tonk Man, about the same period. Yeah, Eastwood said at one point his favorite movie was Bronco Billy. It was more how he saw himself in America. It's just a beautiful movie.
It really is. It didn't go over because it wasn't Dirty Harry, of course. It certainly wasn't, anything like that. But he's a pretty good guy.
Oh, he is.
We thank you, sir. We share your appreciation. Tell me, apart from Clint Eastwood, who are the American filmmakers who enthuse you to an equal level?
Oh, goodness. I mostly work on Iranian, various European movies. Not so much about American movies, although I just saw a marvelous movie called Margaret by Kenneth Lonergan. There was actually a piece on him and his 10-year struggle to get that movie out.
But how do you evaluate the classic great directors? For example, one of my favorites is John Ford. What would you say about Ford and his work?
Well, it depends on which work you're talking about. I actually do like Ford. My Darling Clementine, for instance, it has a lot of the social problems, though, that Eastwood addresses. It's very it's racist. It does have a virgin and a whore. But it's got great music. It's got frontier music, which is kind of fetching. Mm-hmm. There's dancing and lots of feasting. I like that.
And back to the phones, 312-591-7200. Next up is Barb. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. I love your show.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. And I was just wondering, did you have a chance to interview Clint Eastwood? And what is his future on making some more movies? I love all his movies.
Ah, I did not get to interview him because when I finally got through to his agent, he was making the two war movies in Japan. And then right after that, he made Gran Torino and The Changeling. He's just been so busy. I'm going to keep trying. Yes, my son-in-law tells me he's busily making another movie, but he's not directing it. He is in it. It is a baseball movie, apparently called something about a curve.
Trouble
with a curve. So he's a busy guy.
Right. Well, I understand that, but boy, he sounds like he's got so much upstairs that he could release to everybody in the world.
Right. Well, one of my philosopher professor friends said to me after listening to an interview with Clint that Terry Gross did, he's got more brains upstairs than any of my colleagues. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I'm glad the colleagues didn't hear that. But, indeed, he's brilliant. He's brilliant.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call. He's also, I suppose, he's an octogenarian by now. How old is he?
He is. He's 82, born in 1930.
What are his plans?
That's the new 20.
Yeah, I hope so. Right. What are his plans? To just go on making films?
Just go on making films. He's got a busy family. He's got a large family. His wife is engaged in making a reality show. He's busy. He reads a lot.
He's a very estimable fellow, I gather.
Mm-hmm. That's what I hear.
He's even held political office. He was the mayor of what town?
Carmel, right.
Carmel, California.
Right. He made two movies during those 2 years he was mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something else I heard in Europe from friends. He said, oh, is he still a Republican, still mayor of Carmel? And I said, that was back in the 80s.
Is he still a Republican?
He says he's not a member of any political party. Mm-hmm. He did not like the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. There are some conservative values that come through all the same, I would say.
Oh, sure.
In his movie. Mm-hmm. We are coming to the end of the available time. Our guest has been Sarah Anson Vaux, and the book that we've been drawing from is titled The Ethical Vision of Clint Eastwood. That's published by Erdmans. We'll be here again tomorrow night, again for just a one-hour program, coming back to a full two-hour program the next night. And a very interesting fellow joins us tomorrow, but I don't have time to tell you all about it. What I do have time to tell you is that you're welcome to and you're invited to visit our website, where you get all of our programs in podcast. Tonight's program will be up by tomorrow afternoon. All the other programs of the last week or so will be available on the front page, as are many classic Extension 720s. And if you click on to the other pages, you'll find literally hundreds of classic Extension 720 programs, some of them going back a good 20 or 25 years. With that, we are truly at the end of the available time. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.